passport, check. Euros, check. Train ticket, check.
Oh no, I forgot the Flight Free podcast.
Check in with the Flight Free podcast. Imagine where we can take you. Don't forget to carry us in your pocket for destination inspiration.
Hello and welcome to the Flight Free podcast. I'm Evie, and in this episode, we're going to be looking at the link between education and air travel. We all know that school trips can be the most memorable part of our school years, but recently there's been a trend to offer more and more exotic locations that you would have to fly to. It's also the case that universities might attract people to their courses by offering far-flung field trips. We're going to discuss what effect this has on the travel choices we make in the future. To do that, we've invited two people to discuss the issue of education and air travel. Abby Whitefield, who caused a bit of a stir when she refused to fly for her university field trip, and Milan Clower from the Oxford University Flying Less Group. We'll talk to them in a bit, but first, let's start with our flight-free fact.
Flight-free fact.
According to a study at one Swiss university, professors take on average about 3.7 flights per year, emitting approximately 5 tonnes of CO2 equivalent, which is more than 3 times the annual carbon budget of 1.5 tonnes of CO2, which each person could emit until 2050 if emissions were equally divided between all people in the world while still reaching the targets of no more than 1.5 degrees of warming. So, hello Abby and Milan.
Hey.
Hi.
Thank you very much for joining us on the podcast. Firstly, let's hear from Abby. So you were studying at Edinburgh University when you decided you didn't want to attend one of your class field trips because it would mean flying to Morocco, but this was a compulsory part of the course. So can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, so in 2018-2019, I was doing a master's at the University of Edinburgh on environmental protection and management. And I felt rather ironically they were sending a field trip to Morocco to do some environmental monitoring, which I think was a great opportunity for students, but also could have been done in the UK. There wasn't necessarily anything they were monitoring that couldn't have been done in this country. I felt that considering it was an environmental field trip, it felt unnecessary for me to fly to go there. It kind of clashed with my views. And I was very nervous actually applying for the course because I didn't want to go on this field trip and I knew it was a compulsory part. Although I brought up my concerns to the university, there didn't really seem to be a logical way of us getting there without flying. And because of resource constraints, I think the university and time constraints with courses going on. So I decided that I wouldn't go. And actually, my course were very supportive of that. I had to do a different project on my own. I chose to do it on people's perceptions of flying and climate change and their behaviours. And yeah, it led me to try and refuse and kind of make a stir and make them think more about how they were choosing to advertise their courses and also the opportunities that they were providing for students and how those kind of conflicted with what we were being taught in our lessons.
And what advice would you give to anyone who is thinking about taking a stand and refusing to fly for a field trip but feels reluctant to do it, feels nervous about the reaction?
I'd say to be really open with your course leader, course director, just to make it clear how you're feeling about it and why exactly you're feeling that way. Because although it was compulsory, my course leader was very understanding of the fact that I didn't want to go and the reasons behind that. So I think if you can explain it in a sensible way, highlighting, you know, the key important things about not wanting to produce those carbon emissions or whatever other reasons you don't want to go as well, I think that's really important. Just making sure you're explaining the reason and feeling confident enough in your own views to not have to go against your beliefs to go.
Thank you, Abby, for telling us about that. It's really interesting to hear your experience. Now to you, Milan. So you are involved with the Oxford University Flying Less Group. Can you tell us what that is about and how you became involved with it?
Basically, linking to Abby's story, I find that very interesting because usually when I talk to people, it's more the other way around, so that they want to fly and we kind of come up with reasons or alternatives to why not to fly. So it's exactly the opposite story of what Abby just told us. And I think this is really where this whole Flying Less group came from, that a few academics were somehow feeling pressured to fly because there's just a lot of conferences happening. But actually, we didn't really necessarily want to fly as much for many different reasons, right? Some were definitely climate reasons, but others were also like family commitment. So we realized that the habits that we currently have, the practices that we currently have in academia are very much discriminating those that don't necessarily want to fly. I think there's really two things to this flying less group. One is really educating people about alternatives, about the whole issue around like how much do we really fly as academics and how much is that just completely nonsense compared to the us being climate scientists and trying to like save the world from climate change and therefore like well, really being in this conflict of still being, yeah, somehow due to the how the whole system is set up, being forced to like fly around. So at the moment we mostly work internally trying to like change things within the university to allow for different structures. So for example, Oxford is going to get a flying levy, meaning that roughly 10% of the flight costs will be added to every academic trip, and that will then go to like an internal fund. And that's quite interesting because that obviously doesn't necessarily prohibit someone from traveling, but it definitely will create a lot of discussion. And sometimes I feel like whether it's, let's say, 10% added or 5% added, I don't really mind that much as long as we have that discussion.
And do you have any specific examples of people who either within the Oxford Flying Less group or at other universities that you've come across who are pushing back against the narrative that you need to fly to be a successful academic?
I started my PhD before the pandemic, so everything was still in person. I went to a couple of conferences during the first 2 years, and then I basically haven't been flying, I haven't been on an airplane for the last 3 years. So like the last part of my PhD and like the beginning of my postdoc, and obviously try to like do as much flight free as possible going forward. I think it's a lot about communication. We just have to understand that people come with different backgrounds. Whatever that background mean, right? So background can also mean you have family in Australia. Background can also mean that you're really committed to climate action and therefore you have to say like, no, I'm not going to fly. And yeah, I find the solution really for that is that we have to make sure that every system structures we set up never discriminate people that do not want to fly for whatever reason, because it's them to decide that.
Yeah, we're having similar discussions at St. Andrews where I am now, both at a university level with our environmental sustainability board and within our school. We're having the similar conversations about the academics, you know, feel like they've got to fly in order to progress in their careers. Actually, quite a lot of the promotions in universities are based on being international and having these international connections, and some of that is obviously related to flying. We're also having something quite contradictory with the students, the PhD students who haven't been able to travel at all, are now really wanting to because they felt like they haven't had the opportunity and they haven't been able to network. And some of our senior academics are actually being very understanding of that and feeling like, oh, well, we've had those opportunities, so now we can step back a bit from that. And maybe it's the younger students who should be, or the younger academics, the early career academics who should be having these opportunities to fly instead, thinking about how we balance it within our school.
In a world where we really need to reduce emissions pretty drastically, what do both of you hope the culture of international travel networking in academia will look like? How would you see it changing to kind of fit in with our climate goals?
Oh, I'm really optimistic on that. So I absolutely see this young generation of people that use all the different platforms from like Slack to Zulip to GitHub to whatever really channel you can think of, and they manage to like connect with anyone in the world at any time, and they find it absolutely no problem to connect to people virtually. I have a lot of collaborations that basically probably started on Twitter, right? And obviously, if you then come from the perspective that you still think that, I don't know, email is your favorite mode of communication, then yes, there's like two generations clashing, and it is difficult, I think, to convince either group that you can also do it the other way. But I think, therefore, because the younger generation will just take over eventually, there's a lot of these habits that are going to change. But I think for the time being, it's basically just like, my advice is probably just like, yeah, just ignore the senior academics. You can do it your way and you can still be successful. And it's going to work. Like, if you want to do it that way, it's absolutely going to work.
I just feel like people were just so set in their ways of thinking, like, this is how we make those connections, this is how we do things. Whereas, yeah, we're provided with a big opportunity to change, I think, now. And hopefully people increasingly see that rather than feeling the need to be travelling internationally so often.
Have you felt that you can still make impactful connections with people across the world, you know, from Scotland, from Oxford, without having had the need to meet them in person?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of people I collaborate with that I never met in person, and that's absolutely fine. I don't necessarily have to be on a, like, I don't know, level that you like go weekly for a drink with someone in order to work with them. I find this very interesting how we have a different narrative around the like flying less and the flying flight free. I think in academia, we're definitely trying to push for the flying less instead of the flight free, because the flying less is kind of like people don't feel as offended if you say flying less, because that basically can mean that every now and then they could still go on a conference and meet someone once in person, and then they can basically do the rest virtually. But it's obviously not solving the problem, right? I've looked at research into that, the whole inequality in transport that you see on the global scale, on the national scale. You also have on the scale of a single department, where literally it's just a few people that take most of the flights. So if you would just tell them to fly less, then you basically have already achieved most of what you could have hoped for.
I think that's one thing that we really focus on with our campaign, is that not everyone is going to pledge to never fly again. But the idea of kind of taking that year where you pledge to be flight free is that it changes the way you think, and you suddenly, you know, are more adventurous in a way of the way you travel, and you're trying to think of it a different way rather than it being the norm and just the automatic. So I guess as well with academics and that whole world is, like you say, pushing for people to think, could you take the train there, or could you do it by conference? Then if it really has to be in person, you can, but it can hopefully bring those numbers down.
We've mostly talked about trips that seem to be somehow to fall into the category of being avoidable, meaning that you could, for example, do a virtual conference instead, or you could take a train instead. Abby, what do you think about trips where, especially talking about field trips, right? Because we started with this concept of like the field trip, that basically as a group you go somewhere. And now let's say you take the idea of a field trip that actually is so far that you don't have any other modes of transport than other than flying, and you also have something that you couldn't do at home, right? So think about, I don't know, field of like human geography, and you go somewhere and you actually have to interact with these people. So somehow a trip that falls more into this category of being like, well, at least the plane for that is absolutely unavoidable, and if you want to do that research, given if you want to do that research, you actually have to be there in person. What do you think about that?
So my concerns about those kind of trips are whether necessarily it's our responsibility to be doing that research, whether that's something that it is correct you to be researching, but also questions around like accessibility and for field trips more broadly, really, rather than research. These far-flung field trips are not necessarily the most accessible, or these trips that are going up a mountain are not that great for disabled students or those who are needing. So there are concerns, I think, about how people make the decisions to decide where this research and where these field trips are happening. I completely understand that some people think, well, in some cases they might be unavoidable, but if you're really passionate about reducing your carbon footprint, could you be researching something slightly differently? I know that research needs to happen on everything in the world, but maybe we need to think about where our placement is in the world and think about how we can research things more locally to still have a global impact. It's a difficult question though, because how, you know, some people have always been researching the Peruvian Amazon and that's their topic of interest, or concentrating on glaciers in Iceland. And so how do you make, you can't make them stop their passions and think researching their passions. Yeah, I guess it's then thinking about how we balance the need to go on those real field work or research trips with the other flights that we're taking, and or making those trips maybe once every 3 years rather than going three times a year, you know, having longer trips away rather than more frequent.
I've talked with some other geographers before about that, And you mentioned the example of like Peruvian rainforest, right? So like there's also a lot of colonial history to it somehow, in the sense that, I mean, there's not a group of Peruvian researchers coming to Wales in order to look at Snowdonia and like geological structures of Snowdonia, right? And suddenly there was the pandemic, and then people realized, oh, we can't actually go there anymore. We still would like to do our research. We do have some locals that we basically pay in order to, I don't know, organize certain things up front, I don't know, organizing cars and so on and so forth. Can we not do research in the sense that we basically fund them, they can locally do their research, we train them in order to do that because they may not have that education available in their countries. But actually, it is much less us that always flies over in order to be there in person and do the research. But actually, you think about this more as like a collaboration, that let's say a researcher in the UK is based in the UK, and they may provide some funds, and then they collaborate with people, whether they're actually university researchers in another country, or whether they're like, let's say, more locals that would like to work in research, but they see them as like collaborators, and they can actually do a lot of the work in the field. And then they basically come together, let's say, exchange data, exchange samples for whatever they've collected or something like that.
I actually had a big Twitter feud with another PhD student in my school about this, because of going over and doing research where, you know, locals could be doing it, or it could be a good opportunity to fund something perhaps, or I don't know, there's just lots of conflicts of interest, I think, about researching in countries where we have a colonial history, or where it could be seen to not be the right thing, and maybe we should be encouraging those people to research things themselves or providing them with opportunities.
And obviously you stayed in the UK for your research project. Do you feel that in some way has sort of enriched your relationship with the UK? And do you feel like you missed out by not going to Morocco and potentially not doing your research in other parts of the world?
No, I don't feel like I'm missing out at all, because although my research topic is very much focused within Scotland, I can still connect it to all the international literature that already exists. I'm still getting the perspectives of those in North America, those in Japan, those in where deer in urban areas are an issue. But I think some people really would feel like they're missing out. They feel the need to go somewhere exciting. And I think that's one of the issues with, you were saying earlier about like undergraduate degrees advertising their geography degrees purely on a massive trip to Antarctica, or, you know, going somewhere really far flung as a way to get students to come in and make money. So yeah, I think it's just about changing the narrative and changing the way that people think about their university degrees, but just the research decisions that they're making.
I think that even ties in as well, you know, outside of university, outside of academic travel, kind of leisure travel. I think getting on a plane and going somewhere far away is the kind of idea on the what is sort of we see in all the kind of TV adverts. And I think people forget actually there's incredible places in the UK that you can visit that is still an adventure and is still fun. But I think, yes, as you say, when those courses are advertised in that way, I think it kind of feels or is seen to be more glamorous and exciting. And that's kind of the lure in, whereas you still had an incredible experience, but in the UK.
Yeah, it's reframing it to make you not feel like you're missing out on something. There are so many places to explore in the UK or Europe or somewhere accessible via land or train, and trying to think about that rather than, oh, I'm missing out on going to this far-flung place when, you know, the environmental impact is probably not worth you going. And, you know, there's so much great virtual stuff now. Do you necessarily need to go to these places to learn about them?
But also as well, obviously schools and university, you're in a unique position because you're teaching the next generation and having that shaping influence on future society. And then the difficulty is that if you're putting students, school children on planes, it sort of teaches them that flying is normal. But at the same time, schools and university are teaching about climate change, the importance of taking action. So there feels like there's a bit of disconnect there. So what do you both think needs to be done in order to encourage behaviours that are positive for the environment?
I think part of it is making it the easier option. I don't know, if there's a way to make it more accessible to people to travel in a more slow way or not travel at all, then I feel like that's the choice that people are likely to make. I feel like everyone just goes for the cheap, easy option. And at the moment, being environmentally friendly isn't necessarily the cheap, easy option. I think we just need to be more considerate or find ways within universities and institutions to encourage more sustainable behaviours before flights become more expensive than trains. I think there needs to be a way within institutions to kind of incentivize it at the moment, rather than relying on what's existing, because at the moment, you know, people are just going to go for the flights, unfortunately, unless they really care about the environmental impact like us.
Yeah, absolutely. So I, like, really thinking back about my entire education, I think during high school, I didn't have a single plane trip that was a school trip. We once went to Czechia, to Prague, but that was also by train. And I think that was really the first I went to high school in Hamburg in Germany. So I don't know, it's basically to Berlin and then same distance once more. I think that's also really a question of time, right? So I remember around when I, let's say, was like 16, 17, 18 or so, that was the time where Ryanair started with their classical, like, I don't know, 10 euro flights or something like that. And this is where, yeah, things suddenly really started to change, because previously the train was always just the cheapest option and flying really wasn't. Flying was like a luxury for those that didn't have enough time to travel for longer, and they wanted it fast, but it wasn't necessarily the cheapest. And now this has basically flipped. And so I absolutely agree that there's a lot about price. And if you think about school trips going somewhere, and obviously the UK is an island, meaning that apart from taking a ferry off or the Eurostar, there's basically no other way than flying off the island. And yeah, I mean, it just really makes clear that we have to change something on this, on the whole pricing between train and plane tickets, right? I mean, we all know that they're financially subsidized because, for example, kerosene is not taxed as much as the energy that a train consumes, right? And so there is just a lot of necessary action needed from the government to kind of flip this around again, that you say, like, yes, flying needs to be priced appropriately to the damage that it causes.
For the two of you, you know, since you started the Oxford Flying List Group, and Abby, since you sort of refused to go on the field trip within your respective universities, do you feel that you've seen your decisions have an impact on staff, on students?
So I'm obviously at a different institution now, but I know that back at the University of Edinburgh, that course last year had their field trip within the UK. And based on when I made the decision back in 2019, there was a big meeting within the School of Geosciences there to talk about how we're making the decisions about flying and what goes into those decisions. I don't know how much of an impact my decision to not go on the field trip had. I'm sure COVID had a big impact on their ability to travel internationally too. But I think people are considering it more. And I've seen that within my school in St Andrews as well. People are thinking more about flying. But again, I think because of the pandemic, it's felt like there's been a massive upshoot of everyone flying. I like to be positive about the impact we're having, and that people are being more considerate about their environmental impact.
Yeah, I approached this slightly differently back in, I think it was 2018 or 2019, where at the departmental retreat, I was just like, okay, give me some data, like how much have we been flying this last year? And I literally just calculated the carbon footprint of our department. And basically appealed to all these climate scientists, like, by the way, this is what you're emitting. And I think that had a big impact in the sense that suddenly everyone felt like I was basically showing them the mirror of like, hey, you're a climate scientist, but basically this is what you are responsible for. Although obviously the whole responsibility question is a different one, and I don't necessarily like blaming individuals, but it was basically still a narrative, I feel, that was had a really big impact, not in terms of, let's say, flight free, but really like in terms of flying less. My little happy moment was when, I think it was last year, when the head of my department at some point told me, like, yeah, I tried to fly less. I tried to fly half of as much as I flew before. And I was like, wow, that's a big win, like half as much. Like if that would continue like this, like 50% less this year, 50% in a few more years, right? I mean, many other sectors in terms of decarbonation could dream about 50% reduction. And if you just talk to the right people in the right way, achieving 50% seems to be suddenly really doable.
Is there anything else that you'd like to add?
I think just stand up for your beliefs and don't feel like you have to do what everyone else is doing, because that's the norm. Whether that comes to field trips and feeling like something's compulsory, or you know, going for a weekend break in Paris. You can do these things. You don't have to fly. And there are so many other options now to have these international experiences without necessarily traveling.
And I just want to add that all of these decisions make us talk about it. So if I say I don't fly to conference, I've taken the train, and everyone's like, oh my God, you're taking the train. That's so cool. And I think once you have these discussions, it's like the issue is raised. It's on the table. Some people will think about solutions. Might not be directly the people that you've talked to, but the more it's on the table, the more people will think also about solutions. And this is what really makes me optimistic going forward.
And that brings us to the end of this episode. Thanks so much again to both of you for joining us this month. It's been great to chat to you and hear what you have to say about education and flying. We really appreciate you taking the time. And now it's time for Destination of the Month.
Destination of the Month.
This month, we asked Abby and Milan to suggest somewhere that they think would make a wonderful flight-free school or university trip.
Scotland, the Highlands. I'm going to say the Highlands in general, because there is just so much geography for us to study here. There are mountains, there are signs of glaciation. If you're a physical geographer, there's lots of interesting stuff with peat and carbon sequestration. But there's also the opportunities for human geography and looking at, you know, how rural communities are compared to urban. Or there's just so much variety in different places that people can go. And I think it's really important that people realise what's on their doorstep, rather than thinking, oh, well, I need to go to Iceland or Morocco to study this, you know.
Just a couple of weeks ago, as a hobby, I do mountaineering. And so I was in the Alps, and actually planning the whole trip there, I didn't realize what good of a connection getting to the Alps actually is. So you can literally, if you start in London with two train rides, like you swap over in Paris, you can literally get to the foot of the Mont Blanc. So you can absolutely do that in a single day. That's really cool. You take one high-speed train to Paris, one high-speed train to the foot of the Mont Blanc. And I'm saying this as a trip because being there up on the glaciers, it's just absolutely mind-blowing how much of these glaciers is just missing. Seeing climate change in such a volume that is not there anymore, it's just absolutely mind-blowing. And you see literally entire parts of the technically what belongs to the mountain, the glacier, it's just cut out. And you're like, wow, everyone who's been flying around, emitting in other ways, this is just all the CO2 that entered our atmosphere. They just melted all of that away. Yeah, I feel like sometimes it's difficult. Obviously, you can see droughts and so on. But I feel like many of us don't actually clock climate change if they see it. So seeing is such a much more ingraining experience that as a trip, I would absolutely recommend going to the Alps and just experience what climate change looks like.
Thanks again to our fantastic guests, Abby Whitefield and Milan Klauer. And thanks to you for listening. If you want to hear more from Abby, you can do so on Twitter. She's at Abby Whitefield. And to find out more about Milan and the work the Oxford Flying Less Group is doing, you can follow them on Twitter at Oxford_policy. We hope that you're inspired to make 2022 your year of being flight-free. You can sign up at flightfree.co.uk, and don't forget to share the pledge with your friends and family to help us spread the word. Next month, we'll be having some intergenerational conversations about being flight-free, so please do join us again then. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
We hope you enjoyed your journey with the Flight Free podcast. Download the full series on the podcast page of our website and join us again next month for more inspirational stories and grounded adventures. You can find out more information and inspiration at flightfree.co.uk. Until next time, stay safe and stay grounded.